Accession number 10168, reel number 8.
Mr. Donald Price, reel 8. We were talking about who was actually in control in the actual front line, and I'm interested that you say the corporals were the ones that, to you, had most control over you in the front. Could you enlarge on that?
As far as I remember, the sergeants were certainly on duty, but more often than not, the corporals were really the Lance corporals were in contact with us in the front line. Possibly the sergeants were in the support, and they used to come round and give you orders for fatigue parties or going over the top or something like that. But in the ordinary way, they had the sergeants, I think, even in the trenches, they had a bit of a mess, you know what I call them, a mess themselves, and the officers certainly had a dugout to themselves. So, which was probably in support. It was not in what we call the front line. I'm talking about Cambrai now, trenches. And we had a support line, and the more often than not, the sergeants were probably a dugout there, and the officers were the same. They had dugouts, but not actually in the front line. Well, it didn't need much difference, because they were under bombardment just the same as we were.
Do you think they had an easier time of it?
Oh, there's no question about it. You see, even an officer, even himself an officer, he had a batman, as you know. And even in the trenches, I mean, that officer was looked after by his batman. He used to clean him up, clean his boots, give him his food, cook for him, everything else. That's how the officers lived. And as far as the sergeants go, they were certainly I don't think they had a mess as far as I'm concerned, but they certainly had attention, probably better rations than we did. Probably by, shall I say, default, probably pinch it or help themselves to it before it got to us, actually.
Was there any envy about that situation?
No, I don't think so. I mean, you took it all for granted. An officer, you see, he was an officer, and he was Lord God Almighty as far as anybody's concerned, even although he was a junior officer. He was an officer, and he had got to be obeyed. There was no question of saying or even suggesting what you could do. Your opinion, as far as I was concerned, your opinion was never asked in any case. I was never asked, would it be better to go here or go there or watch the trench or in a sniper, a different post or anything like that. It just took it for granted. That was it.
What about, if now we move on, we've discussed what it was like in the line in the Cambrian sector. How about looking at when you pulled out for rest?
Well, more often, you see, when we were out on rest, we were out for about probably 10 days. You were in the line, and then you came right on rest, and more often than not, as far as the Bethune sector was concerned, you were usually in a village. You were either in Burberry, or you went back to Bethune, or Anakin, or somewhere around there in that sector, but it was always a village. And in the ordinary way, you see, we slept in barns more often. More often than not, the billets were barns, or you might be lucky enough to get into some kitchen of some house that was uninhabited. But there was always probably a restaurant, or that's hardly the word. Somebody would sell egg and chips, and you made a beeline for those people, because you used to get a bit of money. You see, we would get we were entitled to a certain amount of francs, which we could do what we like with. And actually, usually or not, if you were in a bigger place like Bethune, there'd be a YMCA there where you could spend your time. It's only about 5 miles behind the line. Then, you see, you could go in the YMCA, have your tea and all kinds of things.
Sticking to the estaminet-type places, what else, what did they offer? Could you describe what they looked like, a typical one?
The ordinary typical, and the ordinary typical drink for an individual soldier like me, see, was grenadine and citron, see, which is a sort of teetotal drink. But it was a nice drink. I used to like it. A lot of people used to like it. A lot of soldiers used to like it. apart from the beer, if the beer was sloppy, we'd have grenadine and citron, which is a nice drink. But, of course, you could always get your tea from, usually speaking, you have your YMCA, or there was another, I forget who it was.
What did the estaminets look like inside?
Well, the estaminets were just rough stuff. There was probably a little pub. There was no such thing as grandeur about any of those restaurants in those days. And the only thing where we were, where the soldier was entitled to go into was a pub. He wasn't entitled to go into a hotel because that was reserved for officers. And it was a very, very strict, rule that those were, and it was labelled for an officer. And the other, you could go away like if it wasn't labelled for an officer, you see. And more often than not, it was a little cheap drinking house, really a little pub. And they weren't clean, and they weren't as a pub or anything like that. I won't say they were hovels, but they were a pub, you know, like a low-class English pub. And as far as you're concerned, you got beer and you got this, no spirits. You got this grenadine and citron, or that foul stuff. I forgot the name of this stuff. It's sort of wine, you know.
You were served by French civilians, were
you?
Oh,
yes, yes. They're all, you see, get a little fellow, French people. They were the only people who were there in then. A man and his wife and the kids probably would look after you in the pubs. But generally speaking, when you got a YMCA or a church army, that was it.
I'll come to that. Sticking to the
pubs.
Estaminet pubs, yes.
They were absolutely, they were manned, if that's the word, by a man and his wife, and probably daughter or children or something. And they you to look after you. You know, only delighted to have you. If you got anything.
Was it always egg and chips you ate? Or
well, there was hardly anything else. It was the favourite thing for a soldier, egg and chips. And you see, they got potatoes. And they got all these chickens round about the farms. They used to pinch the eggs, I suppose. And that was a favourite meal for a soldier. I don't think you could ask for any ham and eggs or anything like that, because you wouldn't get it. It wasn't in existence in those days.
You say you often used to drink the grenadine drink, which wasn't alcoholic, but would many soldiers get drunk on the beer, or wouldn't have enough money?
It's very seldom you saw a man drunk, unless he was lucky enough to get hold of some of this brandy, cognac, that was it. If there was any cognac knocking about, if a man had one or two of those, he was off. But it's very seldom that you really saw a chap that was drunk, because he wasn't allowed to get drunk. See, I mean, if he was, if he landed up drunk and he created hell in the barracks or anywhere, or in his billet, he was for it.
The YMCA places, what were they like?
I think in those it was a marvellous place. If they'd in a place like Bethune, which was permanent, they'd build a hut, and that was a YMCA hut. And the Church Army was another group. And they were all manned by English people, volunteers, women, you see. And it was nice to see some of those people knocking about to talk English to some of these ladies, we used to call them in those days.
And what exactly did they... Was it just... What did they provide at the YMCA and Church Army?
Well, you could always get probably a bar of chocolate or... you've got your tea and probably a bun and a bit of cake, and you get a bit of chocolate, and you probably buy some extra cigarettes or something like that. But it was, to us, it was fantastic to get a bar of chocolate, see, or anything like that.
Were there any entertainments laid on there?
Oh, they tried to, yes, but more often than not, it was you might get a troupe coming over from England, you know. Some of these comedians might come over for a do. There was usually in the YMCA hut when you got these comedians or somebody, some dance people or something, Vera Lynn or somebody would come over. You know what I mean? That type.
Not the equivalent.
Not her, but the equivalent of her in those days. I forget who it was. But we've had them. I remember one or two funny fellas coming over. And, of course, we've got a girl coming over seeing she was the godsend to you. Just to look at her, an English girl, was marvellous in those days, you know, singing.
Did the troops suffer a lot from the absence of women, or a lot of women?
Well, of course they did, naturally. I mean, the chaps were on this brothel lark, or not, and the first thing people, when they came out, they'd search for a girl, if they could, around the village. And, of course, some of these girls were noted, and that was it. But an officer, there were certain houses that you weren't allowed to go in for officers, you see. They were just the same as the men. There were certain houses, dirty, well, red houses that were for officers only.
Mm. Wait, so that's one thing. You used to go to the YMCA and the pubs, as you call them. Were there any other recreations you had when you were out on rest?
No, very, very little in the ordinary way. You see, you'd get up, and more often than not, I mean, you'd get up and immediately run parade, marching or some kind of thing, and then on drill or manoeuvres or something. You'd very, very, very little time for yourself. Only in the evening, we might pack up, say, at 5 o'clock. And then, of course, we'd make our way to the pub for a drink, if you got any money.
Did they have any organised sport for you?
Oh, yes. You got football teams from one battalion, one company to another, or one brigade to another. Say, your division, say, with all these thousands of men, you could always get this. Rugby or football, probably. And that chap, my officer, a chap named Ziegler, he was a marvellous chap, and he was a very great rugby bloke. He got killed, unfortunately. No, he didn't. He got wounded, eventually. But he was a marvellous chap, Ziegler. And we used to have these, might even play another division.
Would you play, or would your ankle?
No, I wasn't good enough. They had some damn good players there, you know. And then you'd have boxing matches, you'd have these fights, you know. You'd stick up a ring, and people would have a go at one another.
Did they have any sport for the sort of ordinary soldier, rather than the good footballers? Would you play? You'd play that at company level, would you?
No, there was no sport really for the ordinary fellow. The only sport we ever did, I ever remember, was after the war when it was all over. And we were given an entrenching tool handle, and there were probably a couple of thousand of us. And we made a circle, and we all converged in to kill all the rabbits we could get hold of. That was one of the sports, but that we didn't have that till after the war, you see. But there were no organised sports like that, as far as I remember.
So it was really for the elite of the sport, athletes and such.
Yes, and... you know, you'd pick up, you'd probably get 11 men for your football, but you'd idolise those, and you'd go and watch. You'd watch the football or the whatever it might be, but anything like tennis and golf and all those things weren't heard of, course, in those days. It was all football or rugby. Mm.
When you came out, you mentioned parades. Did you go back to spit and polish? Were you expecting...
Oh, God, yes. I mean, as soon as you came out, the first thing you had to do was to get on with your doings. Get on with your equipment, your rifle. I mean, rifle cleaning was most important. And, of course, you see, your boots and your clothing, your brasses. You got to clean the whole bag of tricks up. I mean, it was so very important. Everything, your bayonet had to be... clean your scabbards, and your brasses had to be clean.
You had to shine your buttons then?
Oh, yes. No question about that. I mean, we had this, I forget what it's called now. You had to carry it around with you. What the hell were you, Blanker? What the hell was that for now? I've forgotten it now. We used to have this Blanker to make things white. You know, I forgot what that was for, though, actually. But you'd have to clean your brasses and your buttons.
Did you resent that because you'd come out?
Well, it was. Of course you did, but all that resentment, it subconsciously, you forgot all about it. somebody said on parade, and you don't go on parade with dirty boots for a start. It was all a natural thing. If you went on parade with dirty boots, you were probably charged, or dirty buttons, or a dirty badge, or anything like that.
During the day, you were on various sorts of training.
Was that the same
as before, or was there anything new coming?
Very seldom that you're all on this parade. You're disciplined. You'd go marching up and down a rifle drill or something like that. You might have a few groups, and you might be to talk about a machine gun or rifles or something. And we might have a manoeuvre or two, probably have a battalion coming out, you know, attacking some false place. But there was
nothing you hadn't done before then?
Oh, no, there was nothing new at all. It was all stereotyped. The whole bag of tricks, I mean, talking about machine guns, rifles, we'd heard it all before.
Did you do any special manoeuvres or battle training for the upcoming Somme offensive?
No.
I know you weren't involved.
No, we didn't. As a matter of fact, we heard about this thing, about this open warfare down on the Somme, and we were delighted to hear, and we were delighted to think that we'd be going down eventually, which, you know, we did.
But you weren't specially trained in
attacking? Oh, no, there was no
attacking.
Question of training anything. The people who went over on the first day of July, they did training for it, because I was at a place called Orchim-le-Château when I was brought out of the line for being too young. I was brought out of the line, as I say, Orchim-le-Château. Now, that was a place where a lot of manoeuvres had gone on, typical ground had been picked, something like the Somme, and all the manoeuvres and the attacks and the various were planned out at this place called Orchim-le-Château. It was a school, actually, for the training for the first day of the Somme. But me, no, we didn't come into it at all. We just went down there as far as we're concerned. We were going to the Somme.
Well, I think we'll move on to that
yes.
now. It was in July. Do you know which date in July that you were marched
well,
down?
Well, I'm not quite certain about that, but I think by the time we arrived there, you see, we had to march down from Bethune down to Albert, really, to the Somme. And I forget how many days. We probably rested somewhere on the way down. But I think we arrived there. I think it was about the 10th of July when we arrived down there. And
do you remember anything about the march? It's quite a tough...
No, I can't. I only remember one thing. When we got round about the Somme, it was a summer's day, and we could hear these guns at some distance. And we're all sort of paraded on the road. We'd finished the march, and the regimental sergeant major who was with us, he was an old fellow, a very lovely chap, I forget his name now, and he said goodbye to us on the road there. He wasn't coming with us from there on, and somebody else took over, but he was the regimental sergeant major, an old regular, nice chap. But I say he was getting on. I remember his grey hair quite well. And he left us. I don't know what happened to him eventually. I've forgotten his name.
You actually went to Albert, did you?
No, we went to... I think we went to a place called Buire, B-U-I-R-E. I think. In Billets before we went up. And then eventually we probably stayed there a night... And I remember marching through Freecourt. I remember the flowers were out there over the walls. It was a lovely morning when we marched up. We were marched up through Freecourt towards Mametz. And we eventually became entrenched into shell holes behind Mametz Wood. And that's where we stayed for all our period on the Somme. Before the attack and after the attack, we came back to the same shell holes, which were behind the Mametz Wood towards the valley, towards the Happy Valley.
Mm. Now, that ground had been much fought over.
Could
you describe what the... Because it's very different from the Cambrian sector. Could you describe some of the differences?
Well, actually there, it hadn't been very much... It only been fought over by, say, from the 1st of July. And actually, there'd been no war and no battles going on. The trees were there. The grass was there. It hadn't been bombarded like Ypres or any place like that. The whole thing was virgin, really. And Mametz Wood, although it had been, when we got there, it had been captured. But it was still there. You could see, lovely trees were still growing. A lot had been knocked down. Some of the undergrowth had gone. And it had been messed about with troops. But generally speaking, the trees were there. And shell holes on the back of Mametz Wood, you had a shell hole, but you'd still got grass in between.
Was there much more artillery shellfire activity?
Oh, yes. You see, now, before we got there, it was continuous. This cannonade was continuous because... The Somme, as you know, is a massive attack on the first of the day on the Somme, over a long area. But as time went on, it became very segmented, if that's the right word. A brigade or a battalion was ordered to attack a certain thing, or a strong point. And that's how the Somme developed into all these segments all the time. Delville Wood, High Wood, and Ovillers, and all that kind of thing. And as I say, we went down there, and my division got down, the 33rd Division got down there on the 10th, which included one or two battalions of the KRRs and Welsh Regiment, 2nd Welsh, I think they were with us. And... we worked with them, and the attack was planned, partaken with those battalions, you see.
Now, on the 19th of July, you attacked High Wood, I think.
Yes, that's right.
Did anything much happen between the 10th and the 19th?
Well, we were on fatigue, you see.
What did that involve?
When the people who had attacked before us, before we got there, you see, they'd gone up and... They were in the front line, of course, as you know. They're bound to be somewhere up there if they'd attacked and nobody in front of them. And, of course, they got to be supplied. They got to be supplied with rations, with water, with barbed wire, with ammunition. And it was the job of the reserve battalions like ours to furnish them with all this stuff. So more often than not, nearly every day, there was what they called a fatigue party to carry something up to the front line. Might be rations, ammunition, water, or anything else. We always went up at night, you see. You'd go up at night and struggle up with this water or rations or something, and come back in the dark.
So that was what
it was
you
quite
did.
A business.
During this period, you did that almost every
nearly
night.
All the time. And
during the day, you were...
Well, you're in your old hole. You've got a little hole there, you know, a bit of a shell hole, and that's where you used to stay till you were called out. There might have been something else. but that's how usually most people spent their time waiting for this inevitable attack, you see, that we knew we had to go at some time. And, of course, on the 19th, we went out.
Before we get to the actual day... Mm-hmm. Had you been told about any of the plans or what was happening? Were you briefed at all about what you were going to do?
I had no idea, and I don't think any of my pals had any idea what we were supposed to do, where we were going, how we were going to get there, who we were going to attack. There was nothing, as far as I was concerned, that I've heard of what we got to do. Now, on the... On the 19th, we were in these shell holes. I got a pal of mine, Sid Warhurst, and Sid and I had got this little hole. Have I spoken about this? Well, Sid and I were in this little hole, and this little dugout in front of a place called Bezentin the Petite. We were in this shell hole, and we wanted to sit down, and we couldn't. There was a lot of these German bombs there. And Sid said, "Oh, look, let's get rid of these. We've got to do something." So we started exploding these German bombs. And they were sort of canisters and a wooden handle. And you pulled a string and you threw it, and of course it exploded. Anyhow, we were doing this, and unfortunately, we were doing this, and he pulled this. They didn't let go quickly enough, and the bloody thing burst above us. And a part of that tin lodged in one of his eyes. And said, "Look, Don," he says, "I've got one in the eye." And as far as I was concerned, he sent him off. And he goes down with his eye out and left me in this shell hole. Now, that was in the afternoon. And I didn't see anybody for about an hour. I think the officer came along, and how are you, and all that kind of thing. And he went up. See, we'd got a line of shell holes. He came up and said, "How are you?" and things like that. And eventually, in the afternoon, later on in the afternoon, he comes round with a rum. And we had a dose of rum each, you see. And previous to that, I'd got to go down and collect a shovel or extra ammunition. And that meant only one thing. That meant to say we were going over. And I went down and I collected a spade, you see. And more, the other fellows had to carry an extra 50 rounds of ammunition, and so did I, which was in a bandolier, which is strapped round in a canvas thing. And some of them had to carry a bucket of bombs, a canvas bag, which they carried, which probably had 6 mils bombs in. I got to take a shovel. And Sid had gone down. I was on my own. I didn't know anything about going over. Without sense to be going over. But late at night, in the dark, in the morning, it must have been in the morning, probably 4 or 5, it was still dark, and we eventually were taken out about 500 yards towards High Wood, which we apparently were going to attack. Now, we'd no idea, I had no idea what we'd got to do. When we got there, anything about it, prisoners, or who are you going to, where we're going to dig in, or I'd not the faintest idea what we're going to do. Anyhow, we came, we all lay down there ready, because the distance, because where we were, we were in the shell hole for a start, towards high, was over 1,000 yards, which is a hell of a long way, and it was impossible for us fellas, or loaded up as we were, to run or even walk to Highwood. So they took us out about up the slope towards Highwood, and I was thinking it was about, and we lay down in the dark about probably 200 yards from Highwood, ready for the final spurt. And we became under an enormous barrage. The barrage came on to us. God, it was appalling. Screams of dead and screams of fellows all over the place, shelter, stretcher bearers. And by the time we got to the wood, we were nearly annihilated before we got up to the top of the wood at all. And I remember there were four or five of my pals. We were still usually together, you see. And we got up, and it was getting light there. And I remember getting into that wood, and an enormous bombardment of shells and bullets and God knows what. And five of us, I remember getting that side up to what, through the hedge. There was a hedge round High Wood then, which hadn't been knocked down. There was a hole in this hedge, the trees were all that. And we got through this hedge onto what they call a ride, which is it was a big path, really, like a roadway, which they used to have for fire. You know, and we got onto this ride, and we got through this. And I remember one fellow was talking away there, Nolan, the fellow named Dick Nolan he was, and we started going up here. I had a bomb in my hand. How the hell I got it, I don't know. But I threw this bomb where I thought was a movement, and we kept to this ride, you see, because it was the shelling on the wood, the stuff was coming down, and bullets were flying around all over the place. And this bombardment was terrific. And of course, we made a big mistake. We kept to this roadway to go forward. We couldn't go because the undergrowth was so thick. We couldn't go anywhere, so we kept to this road. The unfortunate part about it, that's where he got his machine guns trained on, you see. And before we'd finished, I found myself completely alone. Some of the lads had been knocked out. Some of them had sort of gone under the undercover. And I was completely alone, probably 100 yards in the wood. Now, the wood was only about a quarter mile long. And we were getting enormous the bombardment that did was terrific, and of course the trees were...